So I've been temporarily promoted, but I'll go back to my seat later. One of the suttas that I'm particularly fond of, and I don't usually quote suttas because my memory is extremely pathetic, and it's almost certain that I'll get something confused or I won't get it right. But this is one that I've really appreciated over the years, and I've reflected on a lot. And it's the, probably many of you know it, is the sutta on the acrobat. And there's the two acrobats. One is the teacher and the other one is a student. They are doing a performance, and the master is holding a pole, and he tells the student, okay, now you climb up to the top of the pole and do your act, and I'll look after you, and you look after me. And in that way, we will do a good performance, and people will be happy, and we will get our rewards. And the student says, no, it won't work that way. You have to look after yourself. I have to look after myself. And in that way, we will be able to do the performance and people will be happy. And we will get our rewards. I think in this practice, I know many of the people in this room have been practicing for a very long time. And just the fact that people are staying with it for this amount of time means that obviously there are fruits. We don't usually stay with things that we feel are completely useless and that we don't seem to find any benefit in. And in doing that, sometimes we would like to bring those that we care about into the same path. And sometimes that's very painful because they don't really seem interested or just not very keen. Sometimes they're very happy that you're doing it, but their life has taken a different path, and that's the path they feel true to. And yet you can see them struggle and feel like, gosh, if I could just get them to really start to meditate or to understand some of the teachings, I think they would really benefit from it. And yet all we can really do is just look after ourselves, relying on the anchor points that we have to be examples. And then we still can't have hopes and we have to watch our hopes and expectations, but it's not in our power to change other people or to help them learn to pay attention, to wake up. It's a difficult thing for us to do for ourselves, to really be mindful. So mindfulness has been, Mupur has been giving some really stellar talks and guidance, really down to earth, very, very useful. Stellar. I really appreciated them. And so I was reflecting on what are our anchor points. Of course, it comes down to sila, samadhi, and panya. And the thing about sila, you know, in a way we take a big trust and we put a lot of trust in those three points. And they guide us on a path that's true, but we have to pay attention. So we get in situations in life that we can't avoid where things just seem to all of a sudden explode and they go crazy, or what started off being a normal day, it could be for any reason, some kind of disaster or just electricity going out and you can't get on your computer. It could be some small thing to some major thing. And then that's when we really rely on that mindfulness, that anchor, and coming back in our body and going back, getting ourselves grounded, and then moving in a direction where we actually can do something. We do what we can do that's useful. And we do it from that point, from our anchor points, and then we accept the outcome of that, whether it, you know, success is measured in many ways. And I think we're successful if we hold it together, are clear as we can be in our actions. On the personal side, I have aging parents, and this has been a really rough year for my mother. And so it's, in a way, it's been rough for other members in the family, because that inevitability comes to mind of separation. And I see, you know, my sister, she's very close to my parents and very attached to my parents in a very big way. And she does a number of wonderful things for them. She goes over every week and she cooks for them and makes food that she feels is healthy that they'll also enjoy. And she just looks after them in a really good way. I'm a little bit farther removed, so I can't get there as often. So I do the best I can do. I get down when I can, do some cleaning, just sit on the couch and talk to my mom. And another thing that I do is I call every day on the telephone and just check in. Sometimes it's a minute, doesn't matter. It's not the time that's important, it's just that awareness of, you know, they know they're being thought about, and I get a sense of how they're doing. And then for my sister, I thought, well, she's doing a lot, and what I can do for her is be present for her as well. And in that way, I can support my parents as well, because they know that she's got someone that she can turn to, that she can talk to. And I don't ever preach about what I'm doing, but I can't hide the fact that this is my life, because I live in a monastery. And that was a big step to take, actually. And I'm sure in the early days, my family didn't really completely understand what I was doing. And I kind of live there in a way it's kind of straddling both worlds. It's straddling the monastic life, but it's also straddling the lay life. So it's a bit of each. And I've seen over the years my parents become much more accepting. I have a Catholic background, so in the early days when I took my first retreat, came back from Asia and talked to my parents about it, I know one of the things was that this fear that I didn't believe, and so I wouldn't be united with them in heaven after death. And that's a painful thing for a parent. But what's happened over time is I think they just see the changes in me, and they see that I'm doing something that makes me very happy, that it's a wholesome thing, that I live a skillful life. And it doesn't matter what the religion is, they see the goodness that's coming from my time in the monastery, my exposure to Buddhism and meditation. And I used to have some discussions with my father. At one point, he actually said to me, "Debbie, I just want to thank you, because in our discussions, what's happened is I've become more interested in the contemplative side of Catholicism." And I felt a lot of joy about that. And I actually was the one who got him into reading some of Father Thomas Keating, who does a centering prayer. And he doesn't meditate. He actually did try to meditate at one point, and I gave him a tape that he could listen to of some guided meditations. And then he said, well, I just have the hardest time with this meditation. I just keep falling asleep. And I said, well, Dad, where are you when you do it? Well, I'm laying in bed. He said, well. So, but, you know, it was, for me, I didn't have to, I wasn't preaching, and I felt joy that there were some fruits coming from it in a way that was useful, that he could use in his life, that was helpful to him. And, yeah, this thing of mindfulness, and it's one of those things, it's so simple, and yet it's so difficult. It's kind of like, it's so close that we can't focus on it. And it's so crucial. And I can speak from experience, and I imagine that almost everybody in this room will know what I'm talking about, even though I may not be able to say it very well, is when you're present, when you're really, truly present, you know you're present. It's very different than when you're only partially there. It's not something I can verbalize very well, but it's tangible. It's felt in the body. It's felt. It's just completely different, and I'm sure everybody's had that experience at least sometimes. And yet, it's hard to hold. It's hard to hold that steady, that mindfulness. And I think one of the difficulties is that we tend to get in our heads and we have ideas, or we have experiences where we get a taste, and without being fully aware of it, we're trying to replicate an experience rather than be present again, be really in that moment. And that I think we get confused of what that's really about. I think that happens in our everyday things that we do. I think it happens in our meditation, that there's a tendency to think we've had an experience and that's what we should be having, because it was either, we know we were clear, we know we were present, we know it felt good, whatever defines that for us, that we get that sense of, I'm on track. And so it's kind of like having that ability to be present and be mindful and keep it fresh, keep it moment to moment, to not be contriving something that we think it should be. And it's a challenge. And the longer, I think, we practice, I suspect it gets more difficult, because we become more accustomed to certain things. We become more full of ideas. It's hard not to shortchange ourselves in that way. And this is such a... we're still here. We're all here. So we are getting fruits. This is people willing to take a 10-day retreat during the holidays, when they could be spending time with family or dear friends. I mean, you are spending time with dear friends. It doesn't get much better than this, but but it certainly isn't something that much of the world, many people, can comprehend. So we have our anchor points. We have the sila. That helps us. It gives us a way of facing things that we have to face to bring us back in the moment. A reference point. Something when we have to make decisions, or we have to act on something, or interacting with people, if we can remember to bring those guidelines up, our precepts, reflect on those, take them into our heart so that there's a meaning in our life, that they're tangible in our life, then we can trust from that place that whatever we do, our intention has been to do it from a place of goodness and wishing well. So, and that's a pretty sturdy anchor point. I remember in the early days I would ask Ajahn Amaro, well, so I take the precepts, but what if I mess up? And he'd say, well, great. Then you'll understand it more. If you make a mistake, you'll understand what it means more. It just helps to deepen that awareness. So, okay. And then the samadhi, of course. These things aren't unrelated, of course. They overlap and they weave back and forth to each other. But the samadhi is that anchor point of the ability to bring our attention, remembering to bring our attention to what it is we need to bring our attention to. And to we take these times where we're really honing that skill. We're developing it, we're watching, we're observing the tendencies of the mind. We're really honing that skill of bringing that attention back to the object. And then we take those skills into the world with us. And so helpful when something comes up that we don't anticipate. And we start to get flustered. And we didn't think we're giving a talk today, and then we find out after lunch that we are. And the mind just kind of goes, ah, I shouldn't have done that. But it's like, yeah, I don't have to go there. I don't have to go there. I can, and that's what this prepares us for, this sitting in meditation. It's like, I don't have to go there. I have the power to see that that's where it's going. Is that a skillful direction? Is that a helpful direction? And then bring that back. Bring that awareness back into the moment, into the present. And sometimes you just have to keep doing it, just like in meditation. And then through those things, we develop wisdom, and it comes in bits sometimes, and sometimes we have these insights that are very potent, and then we have to let them go too. We can hold the memory of them, because we learned something from having those insights, but you can't hang to those insights either. You have to let them go and allow yourself to keep moving into the present, into present. Present. And in this way, we can do well in the world and be happy. There's a, I guess, you know, sometimes I think I'm wary to talk too much from suttas and stuff, like I said, because I don't remember them so much, but what I have that I can share is, most of you know and some of you don't, but I've lived at the monastery now for 14 or 15 years. And as I said, straddling both worlds, it's kind of been a bit of a challenge. And in the early days, it was a real challenge. I spent a lot of time in dark places trying to figure out which how to get to the top, where was up, scraping the bottom. And I put myself in that situation, but it really challenged me because I just wasn't sure how to make this work in the form that I was taking on. And I didn't really have any examples, any exact examples. I didn't have any other lay people living there long term. So I was having to sort things out and figure things out. And I was following my heart. It was one of those things where my decision to move up there didn't feel like my decision. It was something much deeper and much stronger. And something in me knew that was what I was supposed to do. That was where I was supposed to be. I had spent the previous year pretty much coming up on most weekends. And it was really clear that that's where my heart was. I started leaving work earlier and earlier on Fridays and coming back home later and later on Sundays. But I used to work for a surveyor down in the Bay Area, and we were in Los Altos, downtown Los Altos, and My boss, the man that I worked with, he'd broken his plumb bob, so he was fixing it. And I was kind of standing at the instrument waiting for him to finish. And this person came up and said, "Hi, I'm doing a man on the street interview for today, and can I interview you for our newspaper?" And my boss, Woody, said, "Sure, talk to Debbie. She's a Buddhist. She goes to a Buddhist monastery." And I was just like, what do you do with that? So then, you know, things come at us from directions we don't see them coming. And so this person started asking me questions about the monastery. And this then he said, so you really get a lot of going out there up there. And I said, "Oh yeah, yeah, I get a lot from going up there." "Well, do you ever think of moving up there?" And it was like, oh, it really took me by surprise. And I wasn't quite sure how to answer that. Because, you know, every time I went, almost every weekend, and every time I got to 101 to the West Road exit, my heart would start pounding. And this deep pounding, and this sweat would come up. And as soon as I'd get there, it'd be fine. But, you know, it's just these things we don't see, these things that aren't clear to us, and they're there in such a strong way. So there he cracked that egg. I couldn't deny that. I actually was like, wow, I do want to live up there. But how can I make that work? And so, and I can remember having a talk with Lumpur and before I moved up and talking about it. And, well, maybe I could get myself a computer and get set up and do, I know a little bit about CAD work now, and maybe I could get somebody to hire me to do CAD work, but what if I couldn't do it? What if? And I remember Lumpur saying, "Well, you're undermining yourself. Why are you doing that?" And then I just, then it was beyond, it wasn't even my choice anymore. It's just that awareness had come to the forefront, and the decision was made. And I remember weeping when I left my job, because I worked with a really lovely man who really looked after me and the other two people that worked with him. Had a lot of respect for him. He was a really good person to work with. I got to see family every week. I come from a close family. There were other, you know, I had a great place. I was paying very low rent. I was living in Mountain View, fantastic place. But there was just, it wasn't me. Something else was moving me in that direction, and I couldn't deny it. And I remember driving up to the monastery, and I had this thought, wouldn't it be funny? This was when I was actually making the move. Wouldn't it be funny if I got up there, and then I decided every weekend I needed to go down to the Bay Area. But that didn't happen. But we're filled with doubts and filled with fogginess. But if we can clear the way, what we need to do comes to us. And it's, again, it's that that knowing that you can't really explain. It's that clarity that you can't really put a word to, and you could never have figured out in your head. It's just like being able to listen, take this practice, and being able to listen, to be present to what truly is coming up in the moment. And so making it work. And what I've really did over time is, first of all, I had to stop comparing myself. And I can't say I've put that down completely. I think that it's so much a part of human nature to just compare ourselves. It's us and them. And until you've cracked that one, there's some level of that happening. And so and I imagine many of you may have this come up, where you think there's a distinct difference between the monastic's practice and your own practice. And maybe not all the time, but I imagine it's there at times, because it's really hard not to do that. And yet we're all practicing, we're all on the path. the monastics are here, and they've taken on a slightly, they've really raised the bar. One of the monks said, when you go into a monastery, it's like you've put yourself into the pressure cooker. But if you really stand the time, some really beautiful diamonds come out. And so, obviously, something drew me to the monastery. And part of it was the Dhamma. But I just was so... the first Dhamma talk was a life-changing event. And the Dhamma is really potent. It's really powerful. So that drew me there. And this is a community that really resonated. Lumpur Cha's teaching really resonated for me. It's so down to earth. And you can take it in, you can take it into everything that you do, in every aspect of your life. You can learn to do that. And for me, that was really important, because I have to experience things. I can't just read about things. I always have to have a taste and get my fingers in it. And so, and also had a lot of gratitude also for the monasteries, because I was able to spend a lot of time at the monasteries in England as a lay resident, and that was a really crucial time for me to get some kind of understanding about what had happened on that first retreat and that first Dhamma talk. So a lot of gratitude. And it seems like all my life I'd been kind of saying, there's something, I have a lot of energy, and there's something I can put that energy into, but I just can't figure out what it is yet. And I couldn't seem to figure it out. I couldn't find it in school. I couldn't find it in work. I had great friends. I worked in jobs where I worked with really good people. But it wasn't the thing that I could put my energy into. And then I came across this Dhamma, and I came across this community, Ajahn Chah's disciples, and I couldn't deny that that's the thing I was supposed to be. That's the thing I was meant to be putting my energy into. That I had to put my energy into, because it was beyond my choice. And so I'm at a monastery, and how do I make this work? I didn't see this coming either until I got there. How do I make this work? Here I am, I'm a lay person and a woman in a male monastery. And how can I make that work? And all I can tell you is, I'll put it in the words of Lumpur Samedo, because when I have the opportunity to express gratitude to teachers that have really affected my life, I take that opportunity. And so when the last time I saw Lumpur Samedo was up at the Pacific Hermitage, when the monks had just moved there and started up the new place, and we were having tea, and I was able to express my deepest gratitude to him for all that he put up with and went through in his own practice and in what he developed, because so much of that allowed me to move in and to develop and to practice. And the teachings that he so freely offered, especially in that first year of practice. And I was able to express my gratitude, and he didn't say anything for a long time. And then he just said, "Yes, you're much happier now." And I was like, "Yeah, I am." And, you know, if you've ever heard Lumpur Samedo, he has a very deep and wonderful laugh. And sometimes it's helpful for people to just reinforce the things we already know, but it's just helpful to hear somebody else remind us of that. So one thing that I found really helpful is I'm living in a monastery, so what can I do? Obviously, I see these monks, and I have the opportunity to be at the monastery, so I see people come in fresh. They come in off the streets, some of them with very little background in Buddhism. And I get to watch how they start to become the beginnings of those diamonds. And they struggle. It's not easy. For some, it's, you know, it's just individuals. It's not an easy life. You're living with people that you wouldn't necessarily choose to live with. You're eating food you wouldn't necessarily choose to eat. You're you've taken on rules, and you have chose that because it was your decision to be there. And there's a form, and there's a form that's pretty strict. And some of it seems, I mean, I'm not by any means an expert on the monks' Vinaya, but I know some of the rules, and some of them probably seem pretty archaic. But what I see is that so much of what these rules instill is a training. Just as in our, we took the eight precepts at the beginning of this retreat, and it's a training. So we're training ourselves. We're training ourselves to be mindful, to be present. And so, so I'm not a monastic, but I can take, there's some that I can apply to what I'm doing, to how I do things. And so it's just observing. And so just in that alone was a training for me, learning to observe, learning to pay attention, learning to see how things were done. Noticing, becoming aware of what's helpful in this particular moment. Wanting to support this as well, wanting to be, well, I am part of the community. So learning how to weave into that realm, being a part of a community that I really wasn't choosing either. I was choosing to be there, though. That's huge. But and so just taking on, like, when I first went there, I wasn't living on monastery property. I was actually living on the neighbor's property. When they learned that I wanted to come up, they invited me to share their living space, for the first period of time that I was there, there was a Murphy bed in the office that Mary would use when she came on weekends. And she was away a lot doing consulting work. And so I would sleep in there. And they were incredibly supportive. They're the ones who actually, now Casa Serena, that was that property. So it was a couple, Peter and Mary, and Peter died of lung cancer in 2000, just as they were finishing all the remodeling on Casa Serena, and many people here have been to Casa Serena. And then Mary, 2 years later, she died of colon cancer. And before she died, she actually offered the property to the monastery, and she really hoped that it would be a place for women to practice. But she also had a lot of faith and trust in Barpasano and Ajahnamuro, and so she didn't want to state any stipulations. She just left it to them to decide what was the best use of the property. So when I was living there, at first I was living there as a layperson. I wasn't even on the monastery, and I could see. I mean, I didn't want to just go there to have tea and sit and have tea with the monks. I wanted to go there, and my whole point in moving was that I realized I could learn some things, and I really wanted to learn. It was a hunger for learning, and so I just started. Just figuring out how can I make this work, and so it was my choice. I decided, and I didn't consult anybody. I decided that I was going to do eight precepts, and just because I was living there and I wanted to participate fully, and to me that seemed like a good way to participate fully. You know, and there's no glory in eight precepts. Three of them are just simple, they're just simplifying life a little bit. So it's not like I'm tooting any horns. There's no spirit. What am I trying to say? There's no great wholesomeness in eating one meal a day. It's not like that makes you pure. But it does simplify life. And since I was living at the monastery, I found that it really simplified life for me. And then, you know, living in a community, the eight precepts was just the natural direction for me to go. And I was still working part-time, but it worked. It worked for me. And then just really learning to develop in my heart. I already had it, but I'm a Westerner, and so it was like really refining and developing that ability to be respectful and respectful of the robes, because I have tremendous respect for the robes and where it can lead people. And so when I first went to Thailand, when I first went back as a Buddhist, it was for Lumpur Cha's cremation. And in Thailand, if the lay people are talking to especially a senior monk, and the monk is standing, and they're standing, they'll go on their knees and they'll talk with their hands in Anjali. And it's very beautiful. It's very beautiful. And I had such resistance to it. I can't tell you. So I'd be with people, and we'd go up, and I remember when talking to, when Papasano came up, and I was with some Thais, and they immediately went down on their knees, and they were talking to him, and they were talking to him. And so I was in this, what we do to ourselves. The thoughts were like, well, they're talking to him, I'm not talking to him, so I don't have to get down. And then I'd go, just get down. No, but they're talking to him, and it's not me, and I don't have to do that. I just do it. And I could feel myself kind of bobbing. And then finally, I just would go, just do it. And then I'd go down and talk to them. And it only took a couple times, and I realized, you know what? It's actually really made me happy. It was such a simple gesture, and it was just so beautiful, and it made me actually, it did bring mindfulness to the forefront. And like, we don't really do that at Abhayagiri, because we've adapted a little bit to the West, but there's still the Anjali, and I know sometimes I've failed, but I try to be respectful. I do the best I can do. And, you know, just trying to think of all the, just watching, learning to look, learning to be, to notice what needs to happen and what hasn't happened. Is there something that I can do that's useful? The Ajahn's just used the last of his soy milk. Can I offer more soy milk? It's endless. And a lot of what I glean from watching these young monks in training, just noticing how beautiful it is that they see things that need to happen, that they're so on it. And it's something that really takes, what I found especially is it really took me out of my own narrow concerns, because it makes you expand the view. So it's just these tools of mindfulness that help us, things that we can take on. That's really what these rules that the monks live by help them to do. And I have a long way to go, but I still have that lay part. The part that straddles the lay world means I have lots of stuff still. And I have more than just a set of robes. And that's fine. That's okay. That's the way it is. But I can work with that. I know that there's certain rules, like there's a, I hope I get this correct. Like if if the monks get a hole or something in the robe, they have a certain amount of time where they're actually supposed to mend it so that they're not letting it go and it gets worse. And it's like treating their requisites respectfully. And just things like that. It's kind of like, I don't necessarily mend things right away, but trying to take care of the things that I have, trying to be respectful of what I have. So I'm kind of at a loss of all the different varying things that I do, but it's part of the inspiration of what the support that we can get and ideas that we can get to support us in our own practice that we can develop just in close association with the Sangha. And I would imagine that many of you are just feeling that on this retreat. And I just see it. You know, it's today, Hitesi hardly had to say anything and things were in place and people just stepped forward to offer the dishes. And it's a very beautiful thing to see people blending into community, doing what they can do to help out, and as seamlessly as possible. And I guess my encouragement is that a retreat is a very special atmosphere. And so we incline more that way, perhaps. Things are slower, there's not anything knocking at our door, we're not being pulled this way or that way. But the reality is that for most of us, even at the monastery, we're not in retreat all the time. And my life at the monastery is actually very busy, sometimes overwhelmingly so. And in fact, in one of those moments where I was stretched to the point where I was completely out of my body, was last week, I was just feeling like there was just so much going on. I don't even want to do the retreat. I don't want to have to give a talk. I feel like a big hypocrite. But then I've heard this voice before, so it's not like it's a new friend. So it's like, but what I see, and what I see more over time, is that ability to catch it, just like those thoughts in meditation, and go back to the breath, go back to the body, and just in that moment, knowing that I've been asked to do this by someone that I respect and have a lot of gratitude to. And of course I'm going to do whatever he asked me to do. And hopefully it will be of some use to other people. It certainly benefits me, puts me in a position I would certainly never go get myself into by choice. Helps us grow in ways that we wouldn't ever conceive of. So I guess it's my what was coming to mind was just wanting to really encourage everybody on the retreat to really to hold it that way, that there are these monastics and they're giving us wonderful guidance and wonderful teachings, and we're not monastics. We don't live as monastics. We have our lives and we have the things that we need to do, but we have a form. And we can mold that form in a way where we're using our anchors, the sila, samadhi, and panya, and we can mold that in a way that helps us to ever deepen, to keep us centered, to keep our intentions as pure as possible, to give us guidance. And then we can do our performance, and we can be happy, and we can at least rest. Things may not turn out the way that we feel they could have or should have, but we can know then that we've done, from our point of view, we've done the best that we could do. And you can't do better than that. And you can't offer any more than that. And so that's the encouragement, and hopefully there's something useful in there, and I appreciate you listening.
Mm-hmm.